Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Gretchen Morgenson is the conscience of the New York Times financial pages, firing off editorial missiles at Wall Street, the big banks, and the regulators who refuse to control their bad behavior. In 2002, Morgenson won the Pulitzer Prize for railing at those financial giants. Today, she spends thousands of words every month trying to explain why so many Americans lost their retirement income, their savings, their homes, and their jobs to the 2008 financial disaster that still seems to be with us. Do you ever feel like Chicken Little screaming that America's financial skies are falling?
Well, they really actually did almost fall down in 2008. So I think that really trying to explain what happened so that people can understand it, so that people can maybe prevent it from happening again, is a worthy goal. I certainly don't think that I would be railing, as you describe it, if things were in better shape and if there weren't so many bad practices around.
You rail well.
Well, you know, it's one of those things.
I like to read your railing.
I just feel like Wall Street is so always a step ahead of the regulators, very, you know, good at obfuscating, very good at selling, very good now at lobbying.
And lying?
That's a strong word, but yes.
It's a good word.
It's a good word, and certainly misrepresenting.
Misrepresenting
to their investors and clients what they were selling for a lot of the years leading up to the crisis. So, you know, if it's just me, a single voice against all of that money and power, so be it. But I think it's pretty important for people to understand.
What happens after you write one of these columns? You get a whole bunch of people screaming and hollering at you saying, why don't you do something about it, thinking that you can?
Well, you know, the most frustrating question that I get from people in all walks of life who read, who listen to me make a speech here and there is, what can we do about it? And it's the most frustrating thing because I don't have an answer. Because the moneyed power is so, the control of the, powerful institutions in Washington is so much greater now than it ever was before, or certainly in my lifetime than it feels like it was before, that people like you and me, people on Main Street, people who are still bewildered by what happened, some of those people who lost all those things you described at the outset, are really have no voice.
It's almost like there's a wall around Washington, around the Beltway, and they don't want to let us know what's going on. They don't want to let us in.
They don't want to let us in. They certainly don't want our view and our opinion, and they don't want us to mix in with all of their, decision-making. And so it's immensely frustrating to not have an answer of what can the average individual do in this very dysfunctional setup.
You recently wrote a column endorsing the idea of a financial products agency run pretty much like the Food and Drug Administration. I have to tell you that since the FDA in the 1990s sort of turned over a lot of their monitoring to the drug companies themselves, I wasn't really sure what this meant, but I guess we're better than what we have now. How would that work?
Well, the idea is to have an agency or some group of overseers who are looking at some of these exotic financial products that really wreaked so much havoc on the entire economy. Look at them from the standpoint of cost and benefits. You know, nobody really analyzes when Wall Street comes up with a new and, you know, usually for them extremely profitable product. There's nobody to sort of say, okay, does this have societal benefits? Is this a product that is really going to help the vast majority of the people who might use it? Or is this really a product designed to benefit the bankers, the people who are creating it? You know, a lot of times that's who the main beneficiary is.
But we had a couple of professors who wanted to do something.
Yeah,
these
are two professors from the University of Chicago, of all places, which is, you know, the place where free market lives and regulation is viewed as
and where Barack Obama used to teach.
Correct. But anyway, so their idea is let's have these products sort of analyzed as you would a potential drug that's going to come on the market. Look for side effects, right? Look for societal benefits. You know,
how would
obviously,
they do that? Did they give you an idea how they would do that?
Well, you know, it's one of those things you want to look at. You would try to analyze whether essentially the product would be used more as a gambling technique or as a hedging technique, okay? Hedging is something that people like to be able to do. It eliminates some of the risk of their portfolio, risk of their transactions.
What is a
risk.
Hedge?
A hedge, for instance, if you have a home and you are exposed to the vagaries of the real estate market, i.e., if the value of your home goes up, you're richer. If the value goes down, you're poorer. You're exposed to those changes. If you could hedge that position, i.e., if you would not be poorer, if you took on a product that would even that out for you, i.e., if prices declined, you would not be, in effect, poorer by owning your home because of this hedge that you've put on, because of this product. Okay, so the idea is it protects you from loss, a hedge, typically. But, you know, so if you wanted to just analyze it from the standpoint of, is it going to be something that is used as a gambling mechanism, like credit default swaps were used to bet
Hold it. Credit default swaps. I talked to myself before I knew before you come down. What is that?
Credit default swaps were an invention of Wall Street in the 90s, which allowed people to bet on whether or not a company...
Invented by whom?
J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan back then. Whether a company, any debt issuer, whether a mortgage, whether a company, whether a sovereign nation would default. And you could make that bet using a credit default swap. If you think Greece is going to default, then you buy a credit default swap.
And if you've got information on what's going on in Greece, then you can make a lot of money.
That's right. Okay, so this was first described as something that could help people hedge their portfolio holdings, but it became a casino. And it really became something that was central to the crisis of 2008.
What's different today? Is there anything different today? You seem to be indicating in your columns that nothing really much has changed at all.
Nothing much has changed. We had legislation in 2010 called Dodd-Frank. It was called the Wall Street Reform Act or something like that.
Bonnie Frank, who is going to retire this year.
He is retiring. And Chris Dodd, their names are on that law. It has more than 2,000 pages, incredibly detailed, arcane, and to me has really overlooked some of the most crucial problems, is silent on some of the most crucial problems that we have.
Give me one.
Too big to fail, okay?
I saw the movie, yeah.
Dodd-Frank did not eliminate too big to fail institutions.
So the big banks and the big financial institutions are as strong and as
in
powerful
many cases,
and as
bigger.
Impregnable as before.
In many cases, even bigger.
How bigger?
I think Bloomberg did an analysis where back
Bloomberg News as opposed to Mike Bloomberg.
Bloomberg News, yes.
He owns Bloomberg
I think
News.
It's 77%. The top 10 financial institutions have something like 77% of the nation's assets held in banks versus something like 50% in 2002. Don't quote me on those numbers, but those are the approximations of how much bigger these banks are and how much more they control of the entire, you know, asset base in this country than they did before the crisis.
People must love to have you at parties, right? They just can't wait to get some information from you. and then there was this 33-year-old former executive director in London offices of Goldman Sachs, and of all places, he decides to quit and announce it in the New York Times op-ed page, saying that that Goldman Sachs was just not the good old company that he remembered when he first started some 12 years ago. What do you think? Did he want a book deal, or you think he really has something?
Well, he got a book deal,
I think. For a lot of money, yeah.
To me, I don't know him. This came in literally over the transom to the op-ed department, not to the business department where I work. I just read it off the page. It struck me
Wait a minute. There was no deal on that? He just sort of sent it in hoping somebody
would publish
it?
That's my understanding of it.
That's incredible.
The idea, but it felt to me, having read it just cold before the whole brouhaha erupted after it was published, like this was a guy just, you know, speaking honestly about his feelings about the company and how
Who
it
makes
changed.
The decision to run that?
That would be the op-ed page editor.
Who's?
Trish Hall.
All of a sudden, I mean, that must have been a shock in the newsroom. Business people must have gone berserk, right?
Well, it was interesting. It was an insider, not necessarily a high-level guy, but an insider who was on a track, you know, successful track at the company, an insider saying, you know, things have changed. You know, it's very different from people outside the company saying things have changed.
Well, you're listening, I'm telling my audience now, to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO Radio. Our guest this time is Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, a former press secretary, by the way, to Steve Forbes when he ran for the Republican presidential nomination in 1996, and a one-time stockbroker yourself for Dean Witter. What did you learn at Dean Witter that maybe helped what you're doing now or maybe frustrated you when you're doing now?
You know, I had 3 years as a stockbroker, which is kind of the lowest job you can have on Wall Street. It was a tough job. I really went into it thinking that I could help some people understand the, you know, arcane investments, et cetera. It's a great learning experience. You actually learn where the bodies are buried. You actually learn the...
Wait a minute. Don't just use something like that. What do you mean where the bodies
are
buried?
You know, the tricks of the trade.
Give me a trick. Give me a
trade. Well, you know, for instance, if the over-the-counter desk, you know, if let's say one of the desks decides that they want to sell a big chunk of a stock, big shares, and they tell all the brokers in the network, we want to sell, you know, whatever the position is, a million shares of, you know, XYZ company tonight, then you know something's going on at that company and they, you know, want to offload it. They don't want it on the
books. And that's not called insider's trading? That's just old-fashioned learning
about,
know, it's like a memo going on?
It's not insider trading. It's, you know, they're trying to offload a position. Somebody brought them the position, perhaps. You don't really know the details, but you certainly know that after a couple times of selling some of those things to your clients and then they later go down, that you're not going to do that again.
So what do we do?
About
anything about these people. We can't. It's illegal to do anything to them physically, right? I mean, they don't go to jail even after they misbehave.
They don't go to jail.
People like the CEO whose name is Lloyd Blankfein, isn't that right?
Gordon's side. You know, he has not been found to have been conducted any criminal activity. I mean,
who founds him? What do you mean he hasn't?
There's been no investigation of him.
Doesn't seem to be investigations of anybody. I see
headlines. Let's go to somebody who, you know, who has been investigated.
Okay, who?
Angelo Mozzillo, Countrywide Financial. One of the most toxic lenders in the history of the
nation. Toxic means what?
Toxic means subprime. Loans that people could never repay. Predatory lending. You name it. Okay. He was investigated by the SEC because they had gotten a lot of emails that he had written to his lieutenants internally complaining about the quality of the mortgages they were making, calling them things like poison and toxic. And externally, he was proclaiming the soundness of the company, that it was on solid footing, that it was doing, you know, all the right things. So that's a discrepancy that the SEC was interested in.
What's the difference between what he was doing and what Goldman Sachs was doing? On one hand, selling, on the other hand, buying? That seems to be somewhat of the same, although I don't remember.
Well, they weren't saying internally, this is toxic, okay? Angelo Mozzillo was saying to his lieutenants, these loans are toxic, at the same time that he was telling his investors, people who were in his stock, that the company was on solid footing, okay? So the SEC sues him because while he's making those statements, those private statements about the toxicity of the business model, he's selling $500 million worth of stock. Okay. So the SEC sues him. They think they've got a case. They then settle with him. He neither admits nor denies any culpability and pays a $22.5 million fine.
But all these guys seem to be doing
that. You would tell me that's a good trade, right? I sell $500 million worth of stock, and I pay $22.5 million to make the regulators go away.
Well, aren't all of these big financial firms making deals with the SEC? And of course, they admit no wrongdoing.
Right.
So what's the point of all this?
Well, you know, it's not a mechanism for punishment. It's not a penalty. They're not going to really think twice about it before they do it again. Okay, so you have to make these fines more of an onerous burden to these people. You have to make them pay out of their own pockets, first of all.
How would
by
you do
making
that?
Them do that, by requesting, by you know, being that, making that a part of the deal. If you're going to settle with me, the SEC, I'm going to make you pay it out of your own pocket. It has been done before.
Where? When?
In WorldCom. Do you remember that company?
No.
WorldCom.
I heard of it.
Fantastic failure. Telecom. Biggest bankruptcy ever in 2002.
Why don't you think this is happening?
the directors of WorldCom had to pay out of their own pockets when they struck an agreement with bondholders who sued them, okay? That was a good precedent.
What about all these people who are guilty of, and I think Goldman Sachs is one of them, still doing some of the same bad old things they did before, and now the government is trying to get them to participate in this crazy negotiated agreement where everybody's admitting they didn't do anything wrong, but they paid $22 billion or something like that. That sounds familiar, right?
This is the mortgage foreclosure settlement?
Yeah, mortgage foreclosure settlement.
Goldman is not a part of that.
But I thought they were being asked to join. They weren't?
No.
Who is? Well,
it's the five large banks, Chase, Ally Financial, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citi.
But I read that they wanted to get some of the other people, including Goldman Sachs, to agree to it.
I don't know about that.
You don't know. Well, it was in your paper. That's where I read it. It's possible. So every time I think about buying a stock or seeing a stock or getting a dividend, I always wonder about, you know, the analysts. And I think about a baby generation, baby boomer generation, you know, confessing, remains in financial diapers. I'm reading this because no matter how hard you work to make everyone understand what's going on, well, what do we do with our 401ks? We stick it in a mattress. I may do that. Where is yours? Yours in a mattress or you?
No, mine is not in a mattress, but it's in a place where, I'm not very happy with it because the returns are not that good.
How do you make a decision? Who do you talk to?
Well, first of all, I'm not allowed to own any stock because of what I do for a living.
Okay.
So I can own mutual funds. So I own mutual funds. And I just try to look for performance that looks good and low cost, relative low cost. You have very little control over these things, and so you just try to minimize the damage that can be done.
I assume you get telephone calls just about every day, maybe every minute, telling you that this has happening and this is happening, hoping that you write a story about a particular stock or something. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, when I get over the transom or calls from people that I know, you know, it really has to be a story that would affect a lot of people. Obviously, big impact. I'm not going to write about something that would affect five people. And so I just try to analyze whether it's something that I really should pursue. Does it have a bigger message? Does this particular case have a bigger message to sort of portray? Is it indicative of a problem that's happening elsewhere? You know, so you just look at it from the standpoint of impact and whether it's important and whether you can try to affect change by identifying the problem and writing about it.
Tell me a story where you actually felt you affected some change.
Well, let's see. There are many examples. I just would point to, you know, the coverage that I won the Pulitzer for, which was talking about the corrupt analysts on Wall Street and how
back
they
in
were.
2002.
The stories were 2001. And it was really when it was kind of coming off of the height of the internet bubble and where you had analysts at all of these major firms espousing the greatness of these companies that had zero track records and so that you would get investors to buy the shares on the IPO and, go to the moon. These stocks went crazy, as you know. And so the analysts were found to have been really just promoting these shares because the companies they worked for were getting huge investment banking fees from bringing these companies public, from doing secondary offerings. I also uncovered situations where the analysts were talking favorably about companies whose shares they were actually selling at the time that they were promoting them. So there was a complete failure of, Wall Street to police these very powerful voices urging people to buy stocks. And so identifying that, then we had a big investigation by the then Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer. We had new rules about what analysts could and could not do. So that was one example. But you can, there are other examples too. It doesn't always happen that way. Many times you write stories and you don't see the outcome, but there are often outcomes that are hidden from view that actually do
take place. I can just see them now. She did it again. They tear up your paper and they throw it away and they want to find you. I want to talk about finding you. But once again, I want to remind everyone that they are finding you here. We're listening to Conversation with Alan Wolper, WBGO Radio. And our guest is Gretchen Morgenson, the editorial bomb thrower at the New York Times Financial Section. Do you like that? We've been told by numerous people the very rich people in this country go after journalists with lawsuits and threats and letters to the editors. Tell me about some of your experiences. You had to have them. Personal problems that you had because of what you write, because of who you are. Gretchen Morgan said of the New York Times.
I don't really have personal problems with these people. I mean, you know, they don't kill journalists in this country, thank heavens.
Well, they have.
Well, typically they, you know, not like they do certainly in Russia or China. So, you know, there is a protection there. And I think that because so much of my stuff is fact-based, you know, there's a lot that people can't argue with. They might not like the, you know, complete the drumbeat, you know, the consistent, persistent drumbeat that I do. But,
What is it? Wait a minute, that drumbeat. Explain.
Well,
the drumbeat
is looking for the truth and exposing bad behavior and, you know, pointing it out for what it is.
They don't kill you here, but Elliot Spitzer tells us they just come after you with lawsuits. They can make life very unpleasant for you.
You know, I have never been sued at the New York Times in all of my years there. It's 14 years. I was sued 3 times at Forbes, but those suits were unsuccessful. People don't like what I do. They certainly try to come around me, go to my editors, complain about my work, try to get me to stop.
Like what? What is a particular thing that you remember that maybe that you wish hadn't happened?
I don't really mind when it happens. I mean, you know, Jamie Dimon called me the other day because he's the head of J.P. Morgan Chase. And he called me because he, you know, said that he doesn't like what I write about foreclosures and how the banks have made all these mistakes. And, you know, he was trying to argue to me that his bank, you know, had done right by most of its clients, et cetera, that they were making loan modifications, they're trying to keep people in their homes, et cetera. And, you know, I'm fine to have conversations like that because that's a give and take that I welcome.
Was it true?
He's telling me he's got this stuff all documented in the annual report that's forthcoming in a few days from J.P. Morgan Chase, and I would be very interested to see it. You know, I'm sure it's true. I don't think he would call up a journalist and you know, make up fictitious figures, because there I am taking notes.
Well, considering the record of Wall Street, I believe they're calling up Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times. Now, he hasn't called me yet, and I've had problems with Chase before. So I would assume that he wants you to have a certain perspective.
Yes,
going
but,
forward.
You know, but I am certainly knowledgeable about the material, having been writing about it for the past 5 years.
Were you surprised to get the call?
No.
No? You get those kind of calls all the time?
I get them, not all the time, but I get them often. You know, so I do not feel that I have been singled out. I have been, threatened. I have been...
How do they threaten you?
I said I don't feel that I've been.
Oh, you don't feel you've been threatened.
No, I don't feel that I've been, you know, picked on or anything. I mean, I don't expect them to like what I do. I'm not part of their PR machine, and a lot of people in journalism don't understand that that's okay. I don't want to be at their parties. You know, if I'm one of the journalists who's in the room at the party, then I'm not going to be able to report on these people in an unjaundiced way. I'm going to be slightly conflicted if I'm one of the people at the party reporting on them, you know, the next day when I go sit down at my desks. I don't want to go to their parties. I don't want to be invited. I don't want to be inside the tent. I want my nose pressed up against the glass doing my job.
There must be some parties you want to go to.
No.
Not even like an annual report, annual meeting, excuse me.
Oh, those are fun.
Those are fun?
That's not a party.
It's not a party if the wrong figures come out, right? How about at home? Your husband, what does he do?
My husband is a government bond trader.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
I must be, what do you discuss at dinner? You can't tell him anything. He can't
tell
you anything.
No. We talk about economics all night.
Oh, we do?
our poor 16-year-old son has to listen to it at the dinner table every night. He rolls his eyes.
Oh, my God. Are there ever any secrets that he has that he can't tell you? I started to say that. You have things you're working on.
Oh, yes. No, I can't tell him certain things.
It's hard, huh?
No.
What does he think about what you do?
I mean, he goes
back to his office. What does he work?
He works for a small money management firm, and he has a long history of working for many of the large firms that I have often written about, and he is right in there saying, go get them, because he's an honest guy, and he doesn't like the fact that there are dishonest people who give Wall Street a bad name.
Did he know what he was getting into when he married you?
I think so.
Yeah? Well, what is it about that? What happens to... I think that the personal lives of people now are so out there because of the internet and because of the kind of things you do. That's why I bring it up. And I've talked to reporters, and they're concerned about the pressure being put on journalists all over the world, actually. And that's why I'm asking you about it. Do you know about examples in the New York Times financial section where these kinds of problems exist? Or friends of mine at the Times have told me that there's pressure here and there.
You know, I would say it's more in the foreign reporters who are in these war zones, who are captured, who are kidnapped. I mean, those are the really horrible stories, I think, that really should gain the focus. I mean, it's writing about finance from my desk at the New York Times. You know, when I read about some of these reports that my colleagues in Afghanistan or Syria now, report on, I mean, I feel like I'm humbled by what they're doing. I don't take my life in my hands when I sit down and do my stories. They certainly do take their lives in their hands every day.
Yeah, but when somebody is losing his or her home, and you know that the reason that they've losing their home is because of something called predatory lending. I mean, you're angry. You want to take, you know, I'm looking at you right now. You're starting to get angry just thinking about it. So, I mean, that's like, that, to me, that's war. What's the difference? You're in a different kind of war zone.
It's not life and death.
Not if you're going to wind up living in a car. It sure is that.
Believe me, I have nothing. I have I am so sympathetic to these people and have done my share of trying to help them. And obviously, you know, the interesting thing is that when you have certain cases of, bad practices, improper foreclosures, improper lending, it's sort of, you know, when the New York Times calls, you know, suddenly things get fixed. But, you know, you can't do that for millions of people.
I just thought about what is an impact for people all claim they know, a lot of friends who think they're smarter than they really are, you know, what is an improper foreclosure?
You know, if you are the bank, you're supposed to have a copy of the note, which is the IOU that you as a borrower, you know, sign to say, I will pay you back for this. But many institutions have foreclosed without having proven that they have the note. So they don't even know if they're the right entity to foreclose. Okay, that's a recipe for disaster. Somebody forecloses who doesn't have the note. Then somebody comes along 2 years later who actually does have the note. They say, wait a minute, two people can't own this property. I mean, it's a mess. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about when I talk about improper foreclosures.
This gentleman who wrote the op-ed page piece said that when he first started working at Goldman Sachs, there was a different culture. He was proud of it. He mentored people. Is that culture so different today?
I would have no idea.
I'm talking about on Wall Street. Is it different?
You know what I think the pivotal change was? That was when all of these firms, which had been partnerships, which had their partners' money at stake, not shareholders' money, okay?
Their own money.
Okay? That's the change. When they started doing the other people's money thing, when they started raising money from shareholders, raising money from the public, they didn't have as much skin in the game. They didn't have as much keen interest in making sure that they were doing the right thing for their clients, that they were also not going to go headlong into a business that was going to lose the money, as mortgages did for many of the participants late in the game. So I think that the big shift was when the partnerships on Wall Street all went by the boards and they all became public companies with shareholders' money, and they didn't have to operate quite as prudently and carefully as they did when it was their own money.
Gretchen Morgenson, thanks for helping us decipher the language of Wall Street. I just hope that our listeners won't start running to their mattresses to safeguard their money all because of you. Joanna Walper is a senior producer of our program. Doug Doyle is a news director. And if you missed any part of this broadcast and want to hear some of our previous conversations, you can hear it all again at wbgo.org/Walper or on iTunes. And I'll talk to you again on our next conversations with me, Ellen Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.